Welcome back, everyone, to What the Bar, the Right Paul podcast. George, Mr. Sophronidis, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, Nathan. Thank you. It's good. We've lasted to a second episode. Who would have thought we've had a second one? But I'm doing well. I'm looking forward. The second one sounds, I think, is going to probably be more entertaining than the first.
Yeah, and I think that's probably because we've got someone a lot smarter than us to come in and give us a hand as well.
Yes, and I did warn you about Nathan about that, trying to bring in more intelligent people than us. But you know, we have to lift the bar, I suppose. And it's great that you brought a special guest along.
Yes, and we're very excited to, on that note, have Dr. Imogen Tomlin Game with us this week. She's also part of the Right Paw team, and also my partner on the Right Paw journey as well. But Imogen, welcome to the podcast.
Hi guys, thanks for having me. I'm honoured to be on the second show. It's very exciting.
Yeah, we got all of our sort of dusted the cobwebs off in the first episode, so you've come in now. We'll be red hot, ready to go, and we'll all hands on deck.
And nothing better than having a vet on board, Imogen, just to, you know, it sort of fits in with what we're trying to do. So welcome. I'm excited to have a vet. You know what? I'm going to ask you with my first thing. What is, you know, one of the things I sometimes despise is Google. And you being a vet, you'd obviously get a lot of Dr. Google people coming into a clinic and sort of almost having everything analyzed and figured out before they sit down with you. You know, as a vet, give me a couple of your peeves. What are some things that, you know, does frustrate you as a vet when clients come in?
I mean, to be honest, I have quite a lot of sympathy with the Dr. Google angle, because I think with the modern world that we live in, almost everyone has Googled it and tried to work out what's happening before they come in. So I have a lot of sympathy with people. I think a lot of older vets get really upset with clients trying to work out what's going on, but I totally get it, because I would do the same thing, I think, if I was the owner. But I think the biggest problem that it causes is people come in thinking that things are much more serious than they actually are. And I think that is a big issue that definitely comes up quite a lot. So I get a lot of people coming in assuming it must be cancer, because Dr. Google has listed all the symptoms in the list of cancer signs. And in actual fact, it's really something very, very simple. And I have a hard time sometimes convincing people that it is actually not that serious. So I think more than anything, that's the biggest issue with Dr. Google.
Yeah, I think everyone's very, very protective of their fur babies. So they want to, you know, make sure, like, it's the trend, you know, we're moving forward. It's sort of pet surrogate these days. And,
yeah,
you know,
they're people's babies. They're people's fur babies. Absolutely.
Interesting. Cause you know, and I suppose just in the way the whole genetics and the way, you know, we manage pets today is changing. I suppose it is too in the vet world, where sort of more online consultation, you know, it's a challenge trying to get someone to come to visit a vet once they get their first vaccinations and everything done. The challenge is, how do you keep them coming back to continue those? Most people visit first and then won't visit again for another 8 years. And it's all time too, where sometimes people just find it difficult to visit a vet. So I'm seeing a lot more mobile vets. Is that something as well that is you're seeing in the industry?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a demand for alternative kinds of pet care out there, basically, and vet care. There's definitely demand for home visits and, you know, mobile vets. I think it's important. Veterinary practices have got to work out how to articulate their value to pet owners as well, because it's expensive, and it is really expensive, and that's genuinely a barrier for a lot of pet owners. So it's important for practices to really explain why it's worth coming back every year for their checkups, why we vaccinate, that it's not over vaccination. It's, you know, as long as they're following a proper protocol, it's still important to have vaccines and a checkup every year, and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's super important for practices to explain why they want owners to come back. Definitely.
Yeah, interesting. Well said. You know, it's something that I'm one of the most difficult things I always find is when it's time to, you know, put your pet down or euthanize. And I honestly think that I think if I have to do that next time, I would love to do that at home, rather than having to put in a car and, you know, visit a clinic where it's a different sort of environment. And I just think that's a really nice way to say goodbye to your family pet, is to do it at home. So everyone's home, it's comfortable, it's a nice environment. You know, is that something that you can see happening, or is it happening?
Yeah, definitely. It is definitely happening. A lot of practices are able to offer, you know, home euthanasias in specific circumstances. A lot of practices get too busy to be able to do it regularly. But that's where the role of those mobile vets comes in. There are even specific companies that just literally do euthanasias at home.
There's one in the US as well.
Yeah,
I think
there's a big
startup that's over the last couple of years offering, yeah, sort of, yeah, like end of life services at home. And yeah, just for exactly the reason you said, George, just to give people that, I guess, sort of quite traumatic and stressful moment. And so to do it at home in a comfortable and familiar, yeah, environment's probably also probably less stressful for the dog, I would imagine,
yeah,
as well.
I think it depends on the animal. It's what's right for the animal and what's right for that family. And not every animal will be less stressed at home. Some animals will be better in the clinic, especially if they need a lot of sedation and things like that. Sometimes they will actually be better at the clinic. But definitely, there's a huge demand for those services, and they are growing, definitely. So I think, you know, I think it's great to have all sorts of different kinds of, you know, vet services out there. It's important we diversify.
And of course, every question always leads to genetics. And one of the crazy ones we always get is when someone's had their pet cremated and they get the ashes, and for some strange reason, they look at the ashes and they sort of think, this is not my pet. This is someone else's ashes. So they ring us with this, can you extract DNA from these ashes and tell me if they match up to my dog? And the answer is no, you know, literally you can't. Mm. But it's like they, again, it's that emotion thing where you get sort of these ashes. And I don't know how you could think the ashes aren't your dog's ashes, but they simply do. They think it can't be the right size. Is cremation something that you see is happening and is popular?
Yes, really popular. And I've definitely heard that same question from people even beforehand saying, how do I know if I'm asking for ashes back? How do I know it is my pet? How can you prove to me it's my pet? And basically, I have to say to them that I have to take the company, the pet cremation company's word for it. But in general, they are really professional, most of the companies we work with. They're very, you know, most of them are specific pet cremation companies. And that's what they do. That's their, you know, their whole business. And they are, the other thing for people who are really concerned about it, and I have sent clients to do this before, is a lot of those companies will actually let you go. So if you really want to see it, which most people don't, but if you really want to go and have a little kind of funeral experience and actually see the cremation of your individual pet, you can. So that's the other thing I would say to people who are really nervous about it, that, you know, find a really reputable company where you can ask your vet if their company does offer that, because a lot of them do.
I yes. like it, Imogen. I mean, if you're just you're in New South Wales, I'd love you to be. You'd be my local vet. Jeez, you've explained everything really well to me.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we're lucky to have Imogen as part of Right Paw as well. And it's interesting, we talked about end of life, because actually one of the things that we wanted to talk about this week, which was really interesting, was around sort of the origin of the dog and trying to sort of unpick, well, where did the modern dog and domestic dog come from? And George, you actually shared a very interesting article on Facebook on your Genetic George page. We should probably take a step back. That's you know, Genetic George. George's sort of avatar on Facebook.
It's a little avatar. I started it to try and help explain information, and it's become a little bit of a fun, and post some new details. And yes, what a great leading to the evolution and the creation of the dog from cremation to evolution. So I shared the paper. It was by James Serpell, I believe.
Yeah, it was. It was a really interesting article. I didn't know too much about this. I think what's really interesting is that it's a lot of sort of, I guess, theory. I mean, we're talking, you know, tens of thousands of years ago. I mean, there's not a lot that we can sort of, I guess, tangibly know about how this all started. A lot of it is sort of hypothesis and conjecture. But I didn't know anything about sort of the theories that were around. But It sort of was looking at how sort of, I guess, the first wolves sort of started to sort of, you know, get closer to sort of the human packs and almost sort of, become integrated into the human world. I mean, Imi, did you know much about this, or did you have any theories that you knew about why sort of where the dog came from?
Well, I think I had always heard about the popular theory of he calls it the commensal scavenger hypothesis. And that's the one that I had always kind of heard about, that, you know, wolves potentially started hanging around human settlements and started scavenging off leftover food and things like that. And gradually the more confident ones ended up spending more and more time with humans. And that's how the kind of domestication process kind of started. But I think the interesting thing about this paper is he seems to be almost, he's arguing that that's probably less likely to be true and that there's a different hypothesis altogether. So that was new to me. Definitely, I think that's quite a kind of breakthrough paper.
It was good. I did like it. It sort of challenged it in two areas. I like what he said. I'm just going to quote a few things about typical humans, how we're noting the side benefits of having these wolves next to us by, you know, protecting us as, you know, village and dump dogs. I did like how, you know, typical humans, how we're able to use something to our advantage quite well. It was a bit it stood out, where he also talked about the dingo. But let's get something straight, Nathan and Imogen. For anyone out there, wolves do make terrible pets.
Yes, I don't think anyone's disputing that point. It's probably a good disclaimer to put out there as well.
And, you know, we have this debate too with the dingo. They are a difficult animal to have as a pet. The evolution and the of dogs is something that has been discussed and something that I present quite often. And if I was to ask you, there's a fantastic little paper that was done by Parker and her team in 2015, which sort of gave us a really nice cladogram. And for those who don't know what a cladogram is, it's just a branching diagram which shows the hypothesis of relationships, which shows you a nice little wheel and grouped breeds in their ancestry and origin. So I always ask this question, Imogen and Nathan, when I talk, and I say, okay, so there was the wolf. What do you think was the first dog based on the cladogram that evolved from the wolf that was domesticated, one of the most ancient breeds?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think I know the answer to this.
Okay, I'm going to give you, it doesn't bark. Its origins are Africa. It's known for its tree climbing abilities. Can you guess?
I'm going to guess maybe like the Basenji, something like that.
That was what I was going to say.
Yeah.
It's the Basenji. So wow, the Basenji is the first, based on the clay, is the first. And then from there we evolved into, if you start thinking about us humans and why dogs are evolved, it was really to serve us a purpose, to help us with our hunting and our gathering. So of course there was what we call the ancient Spitz breeds, or, you know, breeds that evolved after that would have been the breeds such as the Akita, the Chow Chow, the Dingo, the Shar Pei's. They all sort of grouped together. Then we had the Arctic Spitz breeds. And from there, we then evolved. And then we got into what was a lot of the ancient lap dogs, which were very popular. So, you know, the Pug is ancient, the Shih Tzu, the Pekingese, all those dogs. So I've got some really nice ancestry cladograms that I'm able to share, and I've put onto the Genetic George page. And it sort of shows just how dogs have basically evolved based on a purpose that we had for them. And then you've got your group of bull breeds, your guard dogs. So,
yeah, I thought it was interesting as well, because reading that article, they talked a little bit about how, humans would selectively sort of try and keep the dogs around that were actually, serving a purpose. So, for example, if a dog, was more prone to barking, then it would alert, potential, the humans to potential other predators that were around. And therefore, the dogs that barked more were the ones that they would keep with the pack and they would keep with them. And then obviously selectively breeding the ones that had the qualities that they were most interested in. Although apparently the Basenji is the closest relative in it, and it doesn't bark very often. So there you go.
Mm. And there was a little bit I couldn't stop. I sort of had the laugh where it said, where was this little piece in here where it goes, young dingoes were clearly appreciated both as pets and as guardians, particularly among Aboriginal women. Once again, women dominating dog ownership, even in the times when it was early times. So it looks like things haven't changed. Now, if you look at our clients today, most dogs, it was when you go to shows and breeders, is very female dominated. So I had to laugh at that. It was particularly Aboriginal young women who were who appreciated the dingoes as both pets and guardians. It sort of leads me on to another interesting discussion, and you may have heard of this too, Imogen, about the fox experiment in Russia and the domestication of the species.
I have heard a little bit about that, absolutely.
Where they were selecting the foxes based on tameness. So then they were breeding based on being able to approach the fox to be able to, so this is all for the fur industry. So then they were breeding based on tameness. And then as they were starting to select for tameness, they started to see specific phenotypic traits start to evolve. So all of a sudden, a curved spitz tail started to wag. All of a sudden, colors that were more pet orientated started to be seen. A fantastic little project conducted by a group in Russia, the Silver Fox Experiment. For everyone who wants to have a really good look at a genetic study on what goes about when it comes to domesticating, selecting for specific traits such as friendliness, you start to see specific traits that match that selection. You know, a tail all of a sudden starts to wag. The colours start to be a bit more appealing. You start to see some pieds instead of just a straight silver, which was the colour in it. So excellent little article and paper that we're happy to share again.
It's really fascinating with exactly what we're just talking about humans selecting for the traits that they like, that really what he's saying in this paper is that they seem to have uncovered evidence really that rather than just the, you know, the wolves that wanted to hang out and, you know, scavenge of food around the camp, really they think actually it was people in the camp adopting puppies, or they wolf puppies, wolf pups, and keeping them as pets. And that's what they actually think led to the domestication of the dogs. It wasn't so much the dogs coming to the humans, it was the humans stealing little pups and just raising them as pets for fun, and then keeping on the ones that were particularly useful to them in some way, that barked or helped them with hunting or guarding or whatever it was. So it's fascinating. It really is, humans have chosen to domesticate this species in a really specific way. It's so unique.
Yeah, it's almost like the traits, and I can see in the article, you know, he's saying they were looking for dogs that had that sort of hardiness, the sort of tendency to go out and seek comfort or safety with the humans, the ones that, you know, had useful attributes for humans as well, ones that were willing to breed in captivity and had also like a fondness for the humans. So all of these things they were selectively looking for. And I guess, yeah, that's exactly what we're continuing to do today. We're selectively breeding for the traits that we want to see. And that's continued throughout the whole breeding world.
I agree. And let's talk about, you know, the breed that is sort of popular today, the Oodle. Let's look at why it was selected and why it was bred. It was initially done because it was no shedding, could be easily trained, so now, and again, that was something that was required because we had a lot of allergies today in today's community. So again, a breed that as much as some of the traditional breeders sort of see them as a crossbreed, it's a breed that is a new breed. It's only 20 years old. It hasn't got history of 100, and it was bred because there was a purpose of it. Not to be confused with your Merle fluffy French bulldogs, which are different, selected mainly because of just, how can I say, a different factor, which is maybe they're just different. and driven by what
the novelty factor.
The novelty factor. You know, and it's interesting, there's only one gene that controls size. So you look at a Chihuahua and you look at a Great Dane and people think it's 100 genes. It's just one gene. So all this sort of shows you that the evolution of dogs is, you know, it's quite amazing. We've got so many breeds in such a short history. Mm. We've been able to develop so many breeds in such a short time.
Yeah, it is phenomenal. And yeah, the rise of that, I guess, you know, even the most recent breed, like the Oodle breeds, has just become sort of, it's taken over sort of the, I guess, the become like just the breed of choice, the popular breed that everyone wants in their homes. It's interesting though, George, I don't know if you get this question a lot around the shedding nature of the Oodles, because it's not a blanket rule that all Oodles are non-shedding. It's a gene, I guess, that gets passed on, because some are hypoallergenic, some are not. I mean, is that a question that you get asked often?
When you do a first generation, you're always going to get some shedding. You're going to get an improper coat. So it's about putting more poodle in there. There's now genes to be able to test for the amount of shedding. There's also genes now to test for some of the improper coat. So we bunch all that into what we call furnishings, which has become quite popular in the breeding and development of these Oodle breeds. So, yes, you do get different levels of shedding. But, yeah, I love this evolution and just how it all started is such an interesting topic. And I know a lot of breeders love to look at the cladograms, because it lets them have a look at just their breed and where it sits in relation to evolution and where it sits in relation to other breeds that are closely related to those breeds. Like we have the guard dogs, the working dogs, the bull breeds, all those sit together and have evolved around the same time based on the requirement that humans had for them.
And it is amazing, you know, a lot of breeders, you know, they call themselves preservation breeders, because they are trying to preserve as best they can the history and the origins of that breed. And I think it's amazing, because they are ultimately trying to ensure that lineage and the original purpose of the dog continues on for future generations. And, you know, even though you might be breeding a Finnish Lappland in Australia, you know, these breeders are still trying to breed for the original purpose, the working dog purpose of that breed, which was to, you know, to basically be a working dog in the, you know, the icy terrain of Finland. And that's, you know, an amazing, amazing thing that breeders are continuing to try and do to preserve the overall breed heritage. What's your most interesting sort of breed history? Because I find the Shar Pei and the Chow Chow incredibly interesting. You know, from my understanding is they were dogs that were originally bred to guard temples. I could be wrong. I've heard of that. I just thought that's a fascinating.
Correct.
Thing.
You know, who would have even thought that, you know, the retrievers have, you know, webbed feet to be able to swim, and, you know, who could, you know, a Labrador can pick up a duck and just hold it in its mouth without even crushing it. All those sort of things that behaviors that have been bred. You're asking me a question, Nathan, that I'm just going to answer. It's got to be the Boston Terrier.
Of course.
You know, the American Gentleman, as it's known for its tuxedo look. No better breed as far as I'm concerned. You know, highly strung, anxious, carries on, loves George. You know, you're asking me to tell you what I think is, you know, it's...
But what was the Boston Terrier originally, what was it originally bred for? Do you know?
Well, you know, isn't it sort of US apartment living? Isn't it the American Bulldog with the... with some sort of American Terrier. Its closest relative, according to Ancestry and the cladogram, is the French Bulldog. So it sits in the same ancestry as those. And of course, what branches off after the French Bulldog and the Boston is the Boxer. So many people don't probably understand that the Boxer is another bull breed closely related to all those two. And then from there sits, you know, the American Bulldog, the Amstaff, the English Stafford, and then together in sort of that bull breed group sits the Mastiff. So originally its temperament's quite different to the French Bulldog, because it's got that terrier in it, which comes from that American Terrier.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I was thinking, Nathan, you know, rather than us telling, but maybe we should just, on one of the episodes, getting some experts to talk about their breed.
Mm, absolutely. I'd love to hear from the breeders themselves about their, yeah, the passion they have for their own breed.
Mm, and why they chose their breed. You know,
because every breeder has a story. It's something that was deep in their childhood.
Let's listen to it. I'd be interested to know why. It's always interesting to know why someone chose the Chow Chow. You know, why do you choose, you know, the Neapolitan Mastiff? What is it that appeals to you? You know, everyone's sort of choosing the French Bulldog, and the French Bulldog is popular because there's something about those dogs that are born with a screwed tail, you know, the Boston, the English Bulldog and the French. You know, I tend to look at them and there's a lot of expression in their face. And I've got this theory, and I'm throwing it out there, Imogen, I'm putting it out there. You know, if I was born without a tail, such as a screw tail, and the tail is an important way of me to communicate to another dog, then I've got to use something else. And I'm going to use those ears, that face. And there's a cuteness there. You know, I know when I look at Charlie, he can put his ears back. He can sort of approach. His hair can stand up. But he hasn't got that tail to go up or to wag. He tries to wag, but he's more like twerking, you know, because he's got a stump there. And I just think there's something there. And that's why they're cute. That's why people like them. There's something about the way they're able to get humans, you know, looking at them, especially the Frenchie. That's why they're popular. That's why I think they had this real popularity thing, that face, which is able to just give you different ways to communicate, because unfortunately it's got a little screw tail. Now, don't get me wrong, the English Bulldog looks like the only dog that I know would, you know, is simply will come to you even at their time. That's a different chill factor. That's got very little communication, and you know, it's literally one of the laziest and dogs I've seen. But again, great personalities, just the way
sort of they look at you. As well.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true. I think a lot of the brachycephalic breeds, of which, you know, a few of them have that screw tail, they're one of the most amiable types of dog. That's why people love them. They've got brilliant personalities. They fit into people's lives so well. They love their humans. But it's interesting that you mentioned the tail, the lack of having a tail, George, because it is interesting. Veterinary behaviourists do see quite a few behaviour issues with dogs who can't communicate with their tails. So with a lot of those breeds with very short tails or almost no tail at all, or dogs who have had tail amputations at some point in their life due to a medical problem, it's very common for other dogs to not react very well to them because they don't communicate particularly well with other dogs.
They don't know how to read them.
Yeah, other dogs can't read them very well. So it's interesting that even though they're beautiful with humans, a lot of those dogs, it's quite common to have problems with other dogs, which obviously can then lead to them becoming fearful of other dogs if they get, you know, misinterpreted and bitten at some point in the park and things like that. So it's actually a really interesting thing for owners of those screw-tail dogs to know that it's always worth, you know, being really cautious about their relationship with other dogs, because it's quite common for them to be misinterpreted.
Yeah, and look, I know you're right, because it happens to Charlie quite often. I'll be at a park and I'll be there with my partner or my kids, and my kids always go, why does every dog sort of want to react to Charlie? Why does every dog want to hurt him? So then I always have another thing where I go, maybe they just think he's a sheep. He's got no tail, or he's, you know, he looks like a farm animal. But it literally does happen. He always seems to have dogs come up to him for some strange reason, try and get over the top, and, you know, his fur will go up. And I do honestly think it's not having that tail. When you look at the way dogs communicate, that appendage is a very important part of communicating, and it makes sense. And again, Nathan, another great episode. Let's get a behavioralist in and let's have a chat to a behavioralist. But I do think you are 100% correct, Imogen. It's and another thing I always get, they always come up to me and go, oh, mate, dock your tail. And I go, no, this dog's tail is not docked. It is a screw tail.
Mm.
It is born with this type of tail. It's a gene that is only found in three breeds. And don't ask me how it got there. That's a strange one, isn't it? When I start to think of why these three, you know. And sorry to be sort of pushing the genetic test again. There is a genetic test to identify the screw tail, and we do offer it. And in fact, there are some breeders using the test to try and produce. Are you sitting down? We are sitting down. We'll see. French bulldog with a long tail. So we've been able to test and find some carriers of the screw tail gene, which means it's got a screw tail that sort of, you know, anything from 4 inches to 6 inches long. And then you put two carriers together to potentially get a long tail.
That's really interesting, because with what we're seeing now, particularly with the brachycephalic breed, is that there are a lot of breeders that are actually trying to almost breed away from the breed standard to try and improve the health of the brachycephalic dogs. So it's almost like we've gotten them to a point, you know, bred them a certain way selectively, but breeders are ultimately saying, you know, we've got to take matters into our own hands. We've got to improve the way they can breathe and basically try and breed for a healthier brachycephalic dog.
Absolutely. That's something we definitely support with Right Paw. You know, we're really looking for those forward, future-focused brachy breeders who are interested in trying to improve the health of their breed, because it is tricky from a health point of view. It's difficult when you're talking about responsible breeding to, you know, dance that fine line between, breeding for a breed that has a lot of health problems that do come up quite consistently, and then also sticking to the breed standard. It's very hard to do both of those things at the same time and try to progress the breed. So it's, yeah, something we talk to a lot of our brachy breeders about.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's got to be a balance of some sort here, because, you know, you just can't say no to brachycephalic. And, you know, I know there's something that came out, I think, in the UK vet journals now. You can't do any ads with any brachycephalic dogs as pictures in there to try and, but I do think it has to be a balance. If the consumer wants it, then it's really up to the breeder to breed in a responsible way. And it means that, unfortunately, you don't need to accentuate the breed. You can breed for a, you know, less squash face. And let's not forget, we're talking evolution of dogs. One of the most ancient breeds is the Pekingese. You know, that was bred, you know, after some of these Arctic Spitz breeds, because the Chinese wanted a lap dog, so they wanted a face that looked more human. It's not a new breed, it's an old breed. And let's not forget, the dog that won Westminster this year was a Pekingese. So again, you know, we need to approach it in a sensible way. If you, most responsible breeders, and, you know, breed for health. And let's not forget, sometimes you're breeding about what's being rewarded in the show ring. So when a judge awards the winner of this dog to be, you know, this basset hound with ears drop, you know, they somehow need to have a responsibility too, that maybe some of these dogs they're selecting as winners have got some of these phenotypes,
like the desirable traits. Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's almost got to come from the top down a little bit as well. You know, the dogs that get rewarded and get showcased ultimately sets the tone and you know, can almost influence the way that the breed can evolve over the coming years and decades.
And I think that, you know, responsible breeders who are passionate about progressing the health of their breed have a huge amount of influence to be able to change this in the future. So they, you know, the power is in their hands, definitely, to try to, you know, campaign for the right changes in the right direction. I think that's, you know, we should definitely be rewarding breeders who are passionate about health. That's really important.
Yeah, look, and I confess I'm not a judge, I'm not a breeder. But all, whatever I say is just based on my, you know, having attended and discussing and seeing what goes out there in the industry. And, you know, but, you know, that said, Nathan, I do get lots of breeders and I do get lots of judges who believe they're genetic experts.
So, well, you know, you can throw your hat in the dog ring.
You know, and don't get me started on forums. You know, you know, social media forums where you get all these experts. And I've seen some forums, Imogen, where people will post a picture of the dog and ask for vet expertise, and no vets on there, but ask them, you know, what do you think I should do? And all of a sudden, you know, there's 20 experts on forums telling you, giving you vet advice on almost what medication to give to the dog. So
absolutely. That's a classic Dr. Google situation. That would be a pet peeve, George. I think people need to get their advice from their vets and not from, you know, Facebook and Facebook groups.
Look, don't get me wrong. Some of these forums are great, but, you know, there are so many of them now. It's hard to keep up with, you know, someone gets thrown off one forum and then starts another one. So it's difficult. Anyway, I try and keep most of my stuff as scientific as I can on Genetic George Explains It All. So,
yeah, I think that's the safest way to go. So, George, I can see you've got the Bible back again to continue
And talking about Bible, did you know that in the Bible, the dog was mentioned 14 times?
I didn't know that. That's a fun fact to wheel out at a dinner party.
It is. So, yes, I have brought the common genetic diseases of the dog here with me again, and keep sticking to the theme. I think I might ask Imogen for this episode to pick a number between 1 and 188. And you can't pick the number, was it 20?
20. Yeah, I went nice around 20. Emmy, you've got to go for another one.
Okay. What about 120, George?
Oh, you've chosen COVID-19. No, I'm only joking. You've chosen.
Which apparently dogs can detect, apparently.
Yeah, that's right. You've chosen another tongue twister, phosphofructokinase deficiency. And you know how we like to abbreviate things, us scientists, known as PFK deficiency. So PFK deficiency is an important enzyme, or PFK is an important enzyme. It's found in cells of the body, of course. And good news is, straight to it, there's a DNA test for PFK deficiency. And the breeds that you can test for is the English Springer Spaniel, the Cocker Spaniel, and the Whippet. So I'll cut straight to the chase. This is a great book. I should send one of these to Imogen. It's put together by our great vet, Dr. Nettie Maddy, who's gone through and basically searched through the whole literature and condensed every disease into one page. So, you know, when you're trying to get a simple overview of the disease, this is brilliant. So Nettie's done a great job. So this is, Imogen, you would know all about this. So this is really just for Nathan and the other listeners and people that don't own English Springer Spaniels or Cocker Spaniels, American and Whippets, because they would have all tested their dogs for this anyway. It leads to muscle fatigue. It's present around about 2 to 3 months of age. But, you know, diagnosis is sometimes delayed, as the owners may not notice the more subtle changes. And sometimes affected dogs may go for several years before they're even being diagnosed. It's a muscle breakdown product of the myoglobin, and it's excreted in the urine, causing a brown discolorization of the urine. Its activities in the red blood cells is also reduced, and that's where it leads to a short lifespan of these cells. It causes mild anemia. You've got to have routine, can be detected through routine blood screening. So when you're at your veterinary next time and you've got a Springer or a Cocker Spaniel, make sure you take a screening. It sometimes leads to jaundice, as well as the yellowing of the sclera of the eyes and the gums. Mm. There is no cure, as I said, and the treatment is supportive only. You've got to avoid exercising them, as I said, because of muscle damage. You know, you can protect muscle breakdowns with IV fluids from any damage. And, you know, sometimes blood transfusions may be required for severe anemia. So general therapies with L-carnitine, is that my saying that right? Imagine L-carnitine, riboflavin, yes, and coenzyme Q10. And that's really it. There is a DNA test available, as I mentioned. Just go to iRevet.com. Yeah, so good choice. I like it at Imogen because you've chosen one that we can offer a genetic testing. So
unlike me last week.
Yeah, but that was good. Yours was it? Yours was another tongue twister. So yeah, that was page 120 of the Bible.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that is a disease, you know, the fact that there's a test available for it, a lot of responsible breeders are screening for it, which is fantastic, but it probably means that they're less likely to be diseases that you'd find in your everyday GP vet clinic. I don't know, or
yes.
I could be wrong.
No, absolutely. A lot of these diseases that have genetic tests available, it's fantastic because it means we don't see them very often coming through the clinic. So they can be difficult to diagnose when they do come through because they would not be common anymore. Some of them would have been common in particular lines previously, but luckily, thanks to George and everything at Orivet, we're managing to get them really quite rare now, which is fantastic.
And what we tend to find too is if a disease is severe, you do find that genetics is used to eliminate that because, you know, the more severe disease, then the more you have to reduce, you know, any potential maintenance that may lead to a positive. But what you find with some diseases that tend to have a wide range of penetrance that they tend to stick around as carriers or positives for quite a longer time because those symptoms just sometimes are never seen.
Absolutely. That's very true.
George, I think we should end on a bit of a doggy fun fact.
All right. So Nathan, I'm going to put it out to you there. You know, we all know famous dog owners. Let's try and look at it every episode, look at famous dog owners. And I thought, you know, who's more famous than the royal family? And if there's anything about the royal family, there's so many of them, and it's interesting how they all have their own breed of dog. Can you maybe go through and select one, and we can have a look and see if we can guess what sort of breed they may have? Or
I think we should. I mean, look, we won't go for the obvious, which is Queen Elizabeth. I feel like most people know the corgis. They're quite well known now in popular culture. One thing that I didn't know was that she has her own prefix. So actually there is a pedigree and lineage for the Queen's corgis.
You're kidding. That's what I want. Yeah. I want one of her. She's got her own prefix.
She has her own prefix, which funnily enough is Windsor. So there you are. That's my fun fact. But look, we won't go for the Queen because I think we'll go for something a bit more challenging. Maybe what about Princess Anne? Now, I think that's you know, what do you think Princess Anne?
Now, I'm going to confess, I'm not a royal person. All I know is the Queen, and that's it. So if I'm right, and I apologize, is Princess Anne is the daughter of Queen Elizabeth? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I'll defer to the born and bred English lady to my left.
I'd be guessing, you know, from mum, if mum's had the corgi, then I'd say Princess Anne would be a Jack Russell Terrier person.
Yeah, not a bad guess. You're in the right group. You're in the right family, the Terrier family, but not the Jack Russell.
Really? Not the Jack Russell? Oh, tell me. I'm hanging here. Tell me.
Okay, all right. Well, it's actually the Bull Terrier.
What, the Bull Terrier?
The Bull
Terrier.
The Toy
Story dog. That's
the one. The scary looking one that is actually quite a big softy on the inside.
Yeah, you know what? You know, now that I'm thinking about it too, yeah, it's a classic English breed, so they're sticking to their breed, but I would not have picked her. I've got to see a photo of this. When I'm finished, I'm going to Dr. Google and see Princess Anne with her Bull Terriers. Interesting. Lovely breed, lovely temperament, very docile. You know, I've got that really strange sort of egghead again, which you could die for. And we also have the mini Bull Terrier. And sticking to diseases and Imogen again, known for polycystic kidney disease, the Bull Terriers, very prone to it. So, but lovely dog. I can see that there's just a really gentle nature and temperament about them.
Yeah, and a lot of breeders and a lot of people who love the Bull Terrier are almost the ones that want to help promote them to the public and educate people that that, you know, they're often quite misunderstood. You know, they have, you know, the very stocky, staunch legs, very sort of, you know, meaty dogs, and you know, they look a lot scarier than they are, but actually they can be quite docile as well.
They're the Bull Sykes dog from Oliver Twist, aren't they? So I think that's what a lot of people know them from. People who don't know the breed think that they're just, you know, very scary dogs that sort of might attack people, but that's obviously not true if they're brought up beautifully by nice, you know, responsible breeders.
No, I like that. Interesting. Well, I would never have guessed Princess Anne as bull terriers. There you go.
Yeah, and you are definitely right. There's a lot of royal members, and they all have their own breed. So next week we'll have to guess another one. Once again, thanks to Dr. Imogen for joining us this week. I think we're going to have you back a couple more times.
I would love to come back again. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, it was great to have you. Enjoyed it. Loved the conversation. It got interesting. It's always nice to have someone on board who sort of adds to the intellect of the conversation. I'm not saying that Nathan and I are not, but, you know, someone who's, you know, sort of is able to put a bit more credibility to some of the
Some of the banter that we go back and forth on. So no, I think it elevates the credibility of the podcast. But yes, thanks again, Imogen. And George, we'll catch you next week.
See you guys. Speak again next week.